This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Calming a polarized nation. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
A number of groups have been newly created that aim to reestablish civil political dialogue in this country. Hear how they're going about it.
Baltimore is struggling with violent crime, but city officials think they may have stumbled on a way to stem it, and it has to do with reclaimed wood.
Americans are getting bigger, and so are their trucks. Why haven't parking spaces kept up with this growth?
And understanding how Twitter can sink your career when not used properly.
But you've got, as an individual, if you've got poor impulse control and you have a tendency of writing first and thinking second, and there's nothing between you and the typewriter, then maybe staying off Twitter would be a good way to survive.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle on avoiding career death by Twitter. He's here in about 20 minutes. More than 150 optimists from across the U.S. recently gathered at a small college in rural Virginia to chart a course for civil dialogue in a country constantly shouting at each other online and in person. USA Today Washington correspondent Ledge King dropped in on it. Ledge set this up.
In the wake of the 2016 elections, as you know, as most of your listeners know, the country became even more divided, it seems, than it was before. So a group of people who thought it's time to let's bring people together, let's try to lower the volume, decided to bring 10 Clinton voters together, 10 Trump voters together, and get them talking to each other, at least not trying to change their minds, but to create a dialogue. And from that meeting in late 2016, a few weeks after the election, this group called Better Angels has sprung up. And I went to the convention, its founding convention, earlier this month, and talk to people about why they were there and how they're trying to keep the conversation going and make sure that people aren't, on both sides, are not treated as three-headed monsters that should never talk to each other and that they don't understand. So it was a coming together of sorts.
Wow. Yeah, in some cases, we've really gone off the rails. What do they say are the keys to returning civility?
I mean, I think it's a matter of convincing people that if they share their views, they won't be ridiculed, they won't be insulted, they won't feel resentful, because we're not talking to each other a lot in this country. We're talking at each other if we're bothering to talk at all. We go on social media, and you see all the venom that's spewed. And you know, simple conversations quickly devolve into name calling. And so their goal is to slowly build through grassroots efforts in communities across the country this idea that we should have small meetings, small gatherings where people of all stripes are invited, and let's sit down and talk. And we're not there, they say, to change minds. If that happens, that's great, but we want to at least get people together so that there's a feeling that if there is to be compromise and solution, that's the foundation for it.
Hmm. Do they at all place blame anywhere or a starting point where this all started to go downhill?
No, it's tricky to do something like that because blame often accompanies the idea that one side is superior or inferior to the other, and they are careful not to get into blame games. It's not about where we've been so much as it's where are we going. So individual members have ideas. Obviously, there are blues. They're separated into blues and reds, blue being progressive liberal Democrats generally, reds being conservative Republicans generally. And so they're looking more at where do we go from here. They're not engaged much, at least that I heard, in a blame game, because I think everybody's gone through that already.
Yeah. We're speaking with Ledge King, USA Today Washington correspondent. He's written a piece about toning down the political polarization. I thought it was interesting, too. You point out in the story that most experts say the polarization is worsening, yet, as you say, Better Angels is not the only group trying to restore civility. So perhaps there's a good sign there. Who else is out there doing this? Do they try to tackle specific issues, or are they just talking broadly?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, for instance, at the convention I went to, there were workshops on gun rights or gun control, immigration, gay rights. So things like that, very hot-button issues. So they're not shrinking from confronting those types of issues. And what they do, and I sat in on one, what they do is they have all the blues sit down, talk to each other, all the Democrats and progressives talk about the issue first. Then they have all the reds come while the blues are watching, talk about the issues, and the reds are watching the blues beforehand. There are groups like Bridge Alliance, the Listen First Project, Living Room Conversations. So those groups, to varying degrees, have taken on the same mantle as Better Angels. I'm not sure one is better than the other, but Better Angels has an interesting perspective where they want reds and blues together. They're trying to go into college campuses. They're trying to expand in areas where there are very blue areas and very red areas. So they are taking a model of national unity, and we'll see how it goes. They're funded by both conservative and liberal foundations. So there are people, there's money behind it, there's support behind it. It depends on whether ultimately people, especially people on both extreme sides of the political spectrum, are willing to come in and meet each other, in essence.
Thanks, Ledge. USA Today Washington correspondent Ledge King. Thanks for spending time with us. In the wake of our school shootings as of late, certain questions are front and center, like, why do they happen? Or why do bad things happen to good people? We're joined now by psychoanalyst Michael Gellert, author of a book called The Divine Mind. Michael, how do you see it?
It is a very current question. Why does God let bad things happen to good people? In the old days, back in the days of the Bible, God was very involved in history, and he would prevent these things from happening. He would make these great appearances in front of masses of people, as we know in the Exodus story, and he would shape history. But that's not a model we have anymore. With the Hebrew Bible and then the New Testament and even the Koran, God's involvement in history as a kind of a superhero has ended. That old model is called theophany, and what it does is it takes away the individual's responsibility to take control of their own lives and to strive for good and hold back evil. So if God were to come in again and shape history in that way, we would be back to a very old model of the human relationship to the divine.
You know, I don't think I've ever heard that before. That's fascinating. So just giving my simpleton summary here, you think God treats the world differently today than yesterday?
Well, it seems to be, because he used to appear in old times to Jews and Christians and Muslims in a way that was like on a grand stage with huge effects, and God has retreated from history since the close of the scriptures, and he's sort of a silent watcher from behind the scenes. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't get involved in people's lives and sometimes appear in the form of dreams or even intuitions and other kinds of inspiration. But the idea of being a shaper of history and controlling the destiny of large nations, like the way he did in the biblical times, that's over. And the change from one model to the other also parallels the change in the history of our human consciousness, because not only did God step back from history, but he stepped back because we evolved to take his place in being responsible for how we manage good and evil.
Wow. We're speaking with Michael Gellert, psychoanalyst, also author of a book called The Divine Mind. We're talking about the subject of why do bad things happen to good people, especially in the wake of the most recent school shooting in Santa Fe, Texas. Also, one of the kind of the bullet points here I'm looking at, how can you live an optimistic life in the face of such random violence?
Well, do we have really a choice? That question reminds me of something John Kennedy said, that he's an idealist, but he's a practical idealist. And in the same way, we need to be very aware of evil and take a stand against it and do what we can to curb it. But we also need to remain optimistic. Otherwise, we get an imbalanced view of life, and the darker side of life, which is there, can take us over and, you know, shape our sense of what's important and valuable. So, in a sense, we're left with the struggle that, with your first question, we have to be responsible for good and evil, and one way to do that is to just soldier on and advocate good.
Thanks, Michael. Michael Gellert, again, the book is called The Divine Mind. It's 20 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. There are a lot of people in surprisingly powerful positions who have impulse control issues. That's not good if you like to tweet. In fact, it can end your career or damage your company's reputation. How can you avoid the consequences suffered by, say, actress Roseanne Barr? We're joined now by Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm The Enderle Group. Rob, explain.
If you've got, as an individual, if you've got poor impulse control and you have a tendency of writing first and thinking second, and there's nothing between you and the typewriter, then maybe staying off Twitter would be a good way to survive the Twitter apocalypse. Why I brought this up, of course, was the Roseanne Barr firing, which took out the entire show. So when she got fired, the entire show was off the air, and this is a multi-million dollar production with writers, actors, and producers, and the rest. And so all of them were furloughed. So it showed the catastrophic outcome, particularly in media, when you've got a problem like this and the star goes, the entire show collapses. So the idea is if you know somebody's got a problem like this and you've hired them and they're on Twitter and they're in media and they actually have to maintain some kind of contact with the fan base, given the amount of money involved, the solution is to have somebody hired as an interface, and you come up with a Twitter idea. Instead of writing it to Twitter, you write it to that individual, and that individual then looks at it, edits it, and then posts on your behalf. It would be a relatively easy fix. And for a company where you've got a lot of people that have to maintain contact on Twitter, you could certainly have a service. And the service could do that same kind of thing for you once again. So you've got a filter between the individual that does not have a lot of control and Twitter. So the kinds of problems that we've seen where somebody just sees something, they quickly write off a rapid tweet, and then that tweet destroys their career. At least you've got some kind of protection in place so that doesn't happen.
So when you talk about a service, you talk about like a human being or artificial intelligence or some sort of software?
You could. I mean, I'm not aware of the software or AI being applied to this, but it certainly could be. AI could instantly flag the language as being inappropriate.
Okay, yeah.
And possibly, causing a termination. And lay out what could happen if you actually go ahead and publish that particular tweet before you do it. But the goal is to put some just some whatever technology or individual you've got. We're talking about people that are worth multi-millions of dollars, and the loss to the company could cost the company multi-millions of dollars. So employing one person to make sure that doesn't happen would seem to be prudent.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of The Enderle Group. He's written a piece in Tech News World called Avoiding Career Death by Twitter. What else jumps out at you here? What do you recommend?
Well, really, it's a case of picking people, and when you hire somebody or when you're doing the review, I was certainly taking a look at their Twitter interaction and their ability to think through what they're saying before they say it, and putting in place some type of insurance to make sure that that rapid response doesn't cause problems for the company or the individual. The most of this stuff is, you know, somebody tweeting late at night on a vacation. We had that one woman that was going on vacation in Africa and then tweeted something that was completely inappropriate on the trip, just not thinking. It sounded funny to her, clearly was not funny to the internet, and she lost her job. The idea is like insurance or like any type of protection, putting in place a process so that there is a hesitation between that person or a filter between that person and the rest of the world, so that catastrophes don't happen. And for a small fraction amount of money that the person is worth, any either using a service or an individual, it would seem prudent.
What about free speech rights here?
Well, so like anything else, free speech has its limits. You're not allowed to yell fire in a theater, is the example. The thing is, though, when you're talking about your career, really there is no free speech. I mean, you're suddenly telling a sexist joke in the middle of the company will get you either get a note in your file, could certainly get you demoted, and might get you fired. It's the same thing.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Kashenka. Coming up this half hour, are you missing a critical step in your retirement planning? Also, Americans' love affair with huge vehicles is colliding with these tiny parking spaces, and churches okay with smartphones during services? We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. The U.S. Forest Service has quietly launched a matchmaking effort to connect nonprofits employing formerly incarcerated workers who deconstruct abandoned buildings in big cities like Baltimore with private companies looking for a dependable supply of reclaimed lumber. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Kashenka.
It's called the Urban Wood Project, and it's changing the future not only of formerly incarcerated people, but inner cities themselves. Amr Medhani of USA Today has written a piece about how this program is working in Baltimore and joins us now. Amr, what exactly is the Urban Wood Project?
So essentially, the U.S. Forest Service is matchmaking groups, nonprofits that employ the formerly incarcerated that are being put to work deconstructing abandoned buildings in Baltimore with a big user of lumber. In this case, in this pilot project that they've started, it's a fancy furniture maker called Room and Board.
What is the impact on crime?
Well, this is a pilot project, so it's only affecting a small group of people at this point. But the idea is that, you know, part of the problem in cities like Baltimore is that you have a big formerly incarcerated population, and there's not a lot of good jobs out there for these folks. The other sort of aspect of this from the Forest Service perspective is there's a lot of good wood that just ends up in our landfills. And in a place like Baltimore, where there's a lot of abandoned housing, about 16,000 structures, it's both a problem environmentally, and those abandoned housing is also a catalyst for crime. Things like prostitution, drug dealing, trap houses are used with these abandoned structures. So this sort of lets both the Forest Service, the City of Baltimore, and these nonprofits hit a bunch of needs all at once.
Amr, how long has this been going on?
It's just a few months. They started taking out southern yellow pine from some of these Baltimore structures just earlier this year, and Room and Board has been shipping it off to a furniture maker, contract furniture maker in State College, Pennsylvania, that's been turning the wood into various pieces of furniture for them.
We're speaking with Amr Medhani of USA Today. Amr, I know for your story you talked to some of, presumably mostly men, I guess, that are doing this.
Yeah.
What did you find out from their stories? How is this working for them?
Well, it's really important for the folks I got a chance to talk with. I met a man named Damon Toogood, who's a little younger than me, in his late 30s. He spent about 11 and a half years in prison of his mostly adult life. He first went to prison when he was about 16 years old. He and a buddy robbed somebody in Baltimore. His friend shot the guy, and this man died. And so as a 16-year-old, he got lucky, as he would tell you, and wasn't charged with, he was initially charged with murder, but eventually he got off on just an armed robbery charge and spent 6.5 years in prison. Did another stint for drug dealing. But as he says it, the light didn't really go on for him until he got one of these jobs and well into his 30s. It's been really meaningful for him. The best job he was able to get before getting this job, and he's worked his way up to a nonprofit called Humanum that deconstructs homes. But the best job he was able to get before this was working at McDonald's.
It's USA Today's Amr Medhani with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Every day in the U.S., 10,000 men and women retire from the workforce. But with Americans living longer lives than ever before, will they be able to afford to live comfortably for the rest of their lives? Here's one suggested way to help yourself from Jean Chatsky, personal finance journalist. Jean, what's up here?
Some new research shows that only about 25% of people are confident that they're going to be able to live as comfortably as they would like once they get into retirement.
I noticed in one of the bullet points here, too, it says the average cost of retirement totals more than $700,000. Does that include, like, long-term care or health insurance?
Yeah, that includes everything. And as you know from doing these stories, there are a lot of different estimates on this. But the message that people need to take away is that, A, Social Security is not going to be enough. And, B, although saving is really important, it's only half of the equation. Once you have saved, then you need a separate plan to make that money last as long as you do.
Then I always just can't believe some of the numbers
I know
about retirement. Like your notes here, 64% of U.S. households, 80 million, no guaranteed income source to bridge the Social Security gap. I've been doing this show a long time, Gene. These numbers never seem to get better. Why?
Well, the guaranteed income sources is very explainable, right? We used to have a pension system in this country. It went away. Our grandparents, some of our parents were lucky enough to have them. But today we've got 401ks, we've got IRAs, we've got to save for our retirements ourselves. And then as far as an income stream that will last through retirement, we've got Social Security, but it's not enough for most people, which means it makes sense to take some of that money that you're saving and turn it into a retirement paycheck of sorts that will at least cover your fixed expenses.
All right. So I know you're a supporter of annuities. Explain the basics.
The basics are annuities are like lifestyle insurance. You take some money that either you're saving or you have saved, and you convert it into a retirement paycheck, a protected source of retirement income that will, again, just cover those costs that are fixed, that you can expect. And it enables you to get away from having to worry about the volatility in the market, because you don't have to rush to cash out 401k funds when the market is at a low. And as you know from doing this for such a long time, people got creamed in 2007, 2008 when they had to cash out.
All right. So when you have an annuity, though, that can go up and down yearly based on the performance?
No, what you're essentially doing, look, there are a lot of different kinds of annuities, okay. And there are a lot of different permutations, and we're not talking about any specific product here. Just the sense that if you've got some sort of a retirement paycheck, that's a stabilizing factor, and you can get an education about annuities and about lifetime income at retireyourrisk.org, which was set up by this new not-for-profit, the Alliance for Lifetime Income.
Thanks, Gene. Gene Chatsky, personal finance journalist. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. America's love affair with jumbo-sized vehicles continues to grow, and so do the headaches involved with trying to park them. Many downtown garages and parking lots sprouted in the late 70s and 80s when sales of smaller cars were on the rise. Wall Street Journal auto reporter Christina Rogers says the standard parking spot in the U.S., about 8 to 9 feet wide and about 18 feet deep, has budged little since then. Christina, what have you found?
The trend here, like elsewhere in the country, has been towards bigger SUVs and trucks, and they pretty much dominate the streets here. And I park in downtown Detroit, which is kind of seeing its own revitalization, and it's become quite crowded. So parking has become a challenge. And so the more I looked into it, the more I kind of realized that, you know, vehicles are indeed getting bigger, not just because people are buying bigger vehicles, but also each new model generation, a vehicle grows in size and length and width. But parking spaces have not.
Right.
So that's created some headaches.
There's been no parking space striping or marking expansion to go along with the growth of vehicle size. Is there any hope for that?
In fact, what we are seeing is more municipalities use compact spots, compact car spots, which are significantly smaller than the standard spot, so they can cram more parking into crowded downtown areas. I did ask around. I was trying to find some examples of either, you know, retailers or cities or developers that have created larger parking spots, and I didn't really come up with anything. So while a standard spot today should fit most vehicles, it's still creating a tighter squeeze.
Boy, you told the story of the one woman who pulled in a spot and it was so tight on either side, by the time she came back to get the vehicle, she crawled through the hatch right in the back.
Actually, I've heard that story from a number of people. She was the one that we quoted. But I had a couple of people comment that, you know, either they were too close to a wall, or and someone came in next to them, or it was just that their car was like sandwiched between two big SUVs. I also heard of people having so little space between the cars that they've had to climb in the window. It certainly made getting in and out of your vehicle much tougher.
Wall Street Journal automotive reporter Christina Rogers, who's in Detroit. It is 7 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Don't forget, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username @GordonDeal. Well, normally it's frowned upon to be on an electronic device in church, right? But what if you're the pastor? A recent story from Slate pointed out that at the royal wedding a few weeks ago, Bishop Michael Curry's sermon wasn't read off paper. It was read on an iPad. His usage of the iPad wasn't the only way parishes are starting to embrace technology. People are using their phones to take pictures of their kids if they're part of the service, post videos of the Mass on social media, and even respond anonymously to the pastor's sermon. The most significant change is the rise of the Scripture app, which has provided an alternative to the printed Bibles many Christians use. This app allows readers to read the 1,000-page Bible all on their electronic device with a simple tap on the screen. While many remain old-fashioned and think phones should stay in our pockets during church, more and more people are starting to believe that technology can actually bring them closer to God. Just put the thing on silent. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, our contributing writer, Max Chadwick, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.